looking for a film screening and conversation about immigration and asylum. We'll show the new short doc, Far From Home, about an Afghan refugee living in India. Then we'll talk with the film's director, one of its subjects, and an Afghan refugee living in the Bay who now helps others navigate their journey. This special event is happening tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at 220 Montgomery Street, just two blocks from the Montgomery Street BART and Muni station. You can find more information at kalw.org/events.
This is 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco. State of the Bay is next.
Welcome to State of the Bay. This is Ethan Elkind. Every Monday night, we are live and local with news, conversation, and culture from this place we call home. Tonight, we'll hear from State Senator Scott Wiener about a landmark new artificial intelligence safety measure that Governor Newsom recently signed into law. Then, autonomous vehicles are no longer a novel sight on Bay Area streets. We'll sit down with a panel of experts to discuss how their increasing presence might change our cities and our lives. And finally, we'll meet the director of Fairyland, a vibrant coming-of-age story set in San Francisco. That's all coming up, but first, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump has authorized more than 300 members of the Illinois National Guard to be deployed to Chicago for at least 60 days. That's amid his crackdown on crime and illegal immigration in the city. Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker says Trump is intentionally escalating violence.
Let me be clear. Donald Trump is using our service members as political props and as pawns in his illegal effort to militarize our nation's cities.
Illinois and Chicago are suing to stop Trump from sending troops to the city. The White House says the National Guard is addressing what it calls ongoing violent riots and lawlessness. Protesters and journalists in Chicago are also suing the Trump administration over claims that federal agents' tactics are part of an effort to, quote, silence the press and civilians. There have been frequent protests since Trump's immigration actions began in the city last month. The most tense have been outside a processing center where immigration officers have used aggressive tactics, including physical force and chemical agents. The new parent company of CBS is hiring Free Press co-founder Barry Weiss as the editor-in-chief of its news division. NPR's David Folkenflik reports Skydance Media is also set to acquire her news site, known for its criticism of the media.
In recent months, the former and new ownership of CBS have announced a series of moves. The cancellation of Stephen Colbert's late-night show, which often satirized President Trump, paying Trump $16 million to settle his lawsuit over a 60 Minutes interview of then-Vice President Kamala Harris last year, naming a conservative former think tank chief to be an ombudsman. Now, Barry Weiss arrives as a top executive. She is to work in partnership with CBS News President Tom Cebrowski. She has no experience in broadcast and is unlikely to direct logistics, but Weiss is to have the remit to reshape journalistic sensibilities at the network of Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Madagascar's president has named a new prime minister. As Michael Koloki reports, the announcement comes amid ongoing anti-government protests across the island nation.
A week after dissolving the country's government, President Andry Rajoelina has named Rufin Zafisambo, a military general, as Madagascar's new prime minister. For more than 2 weeks, protesters have been calling for an end to frequent water and power cuts. They have also denounced the government and called for the president to step down. But Mr. Rajoelina has given no indication he will resign. Earlier in the day, police fired tear gas to disperse protesters in the capital, Antananarivo. Protests were also reported in a number of other cities in the country. According to the United Nations, several people were killed and many others injured during the initial days of the protests. For NPR News, I'm Michael Kaluki in Nairobi.
Wall Street added it to its records today as technology stocks keep rising. The S&P 500 added 4.4% today, coming off its record highs. This is NPR.
Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. We're seeing more and more autonomous vehicles on Bay Area streets. They're driving passengers to work, to school, to nights on the town, and soon they're going to be taking travelers to and from airports, including SFO. So later this hour, I'll be talking with a panel of experts to discuss how the proliferation of driverless cars might change our cities and our lives. And then we're going to hear from the director of Fairyland, a coming-of-age film set in San Francisco. It's a tender father-daughter story that captures the city's bohemian spirit and the heartbreak of the AIDS crisis. But first, California is once again stepping into the national spotlight on technology policy. Last week, Governor Gavin Newsom signed into law the Transparency and Frontier Artificial Intelligence Act, known as SB 53. The measure sets new rules for how companies developing the most advanced AI models must disclose their safety practices and report potential risks. Here tonight to tell us all about the new law, how it will work, and why it's important is the bill's author, State Senator Scott Wiener. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Senator Wiener. But wonderful to have you join us, and congratulations on getting this measure signed into law. So can you start by just explaining in plain terms what SB 53 does and why you felt it was necessary?
Sure. Artificial intelligence is has a lot of promise to make the world a better place, to help us cure diseases that we thought were incurable, to create new antibiotics, to help us solve problems that may have seemed unsolvable, perhaps climate change, to help us make people's lives easier on a day-to-day basis. There's a lot of promise in terms of benefiting humanity. But as with any powerful technology, and this is an incredibly powerful technology, there are also risks. And those risks are varied, whether it's deepfakes and deepfake revenge porn or copyright issues or changes to work in ways that could be quite impactful and potentially cause disruption, to catastrophic risks. And that's what we were focused on in SB 53, which is how do we have transparency to make sure that AI labs that are creating incredibly large, powerful models are actually taking safety seriously around issues like, for example, an AI model helping shut down the banking system or the electric grid or creating a chemical or biological weapon, for example. Mm-hmm. The labs all say that they're taking safety very seriously and that they have protocols in place as they develop these models. But right now it's the honor system. So SB 53 will require these labs to disclose their safety protocols. It will protect whistleblowers at the labs who blow the whistle on an unsafe situation. And then it also creates a new program called CalCompute to expand and democratize access to the compute necessary to develop and innovate.
So, Senator Wiener, I want to delve into each of those elements of the bill. But before we get to that, I know you introduced a more aggressive bill regulating AI last year, SB 1047, that was strongly opposed by the tech industry, ultimately vetoed by Governor Newsom. How did you adapt that bill to arrive at this version that the governor signed? What are some of the key differences?
Sure, SB 1047 was our first effort to address catastrophic risk of large AI models. And it took a particular approach about ensuring accountability and ensuring that labs were performing safety testing and if they weren't imposing liability. It created a shall we say, a major conversation or its own weather system, as the governor described it in his veto message, and significant opposition by the big tech companies, by some of the small companies. We also had support from a number of smaller AI companies, but ultimately the governor vetoed the bill. In his veto message, he convened a working group of respected minds in the AI field, which produced a working group report and with policy recommendations in June. So we incorporated a number of those recommendations into SB 53, and we're grateful that the governor signed it.
And so you talked about some of the safety frameworks and disclosure requirements. How are these actually going to work in practice, and how will the state enforce this bill?
So if a company does not comply with it, there are penalties in place, and the state can and will enforce it. And so I do believe we'll have good compliance. And so larger companies will have more transparency requirements. Smaller companies will have more limited transparency requirements. So we tried to scale it to understand that smaller companies have more limited capacity for this kind of compliance. I think they're very straightforward requirements. There's no reason for companies not to comply with them. And there are penalties if they refuse to do so.
And you mentioned the whistleblower protections. Why was that important to include those provisions for employees who are alarmed by what they might be seeing their AI companies doing?
Yeah, and the whistleblower protections have been consistent in both last year's bill and this year's bill. And the reason why they were important is existing whistleblower protections are triggered when an employee reports a violation of the law. But what we're talking about here is not necessarily a violation of the law. So if someone who's helping develop a large, powerful AI model at a AI lab sees something dangerous in that model and wants to report it, that may not be a violation of the law that they're reporting. It's simply a dangerous capability of the model that's being developed. So existing law would not extend to that situation. So we had to create a new kind of whistleblower protection to protect not just against reporting a violation of the law, but rather reporting a dangerous capability of an AI model.
So we're speaking with San Francisco State Senator Scott Wiener about his new law that Governor Gavin Newsom just signed, the Transparency and Frontier Artificial Intelligence Act, also known as SB 53. You're listening to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. And Senator Wiener, I know, I'm assuming the technology companies weren't too happy about this version of your approach on AI either. And I know some of them have warned that there's going to be a patchwork now of state legislation that could put too much of a burden on AI companies. So how does California's law fit in that you just authored here, fit into the broader national and global debate on AI safety?
Yeah, and Anthropic, which is one of the large AI labs, did support the bill. There were other tech companies that opposed it. Some were neutral. So, listen, in an ideal world, the AI regulation would be handled by Congress, which would pass a comprehensive, strong law to protect public safety while also encouraging innovation. And that would be great. That's not the world and the reality that we're living in. Congress has yet to pass a data privacy law in the year 2025. Congress has never passed a net neutrality law. So we, in California, we passed our own data privacy law. We passed our own net neutrality law, which I authored in 2018. And we have a responsibility in California, particularly in the absence of federal action. In California, we have a responsibility to step up and lead. We are the fourth or fifth largest economy in the world, depending on the day. We are the heartland of tech innovation, and particularly AI innovation. And we should also be leading on innovation around AI safety. So it makes sense for California to step up, particularly in the absence of federal action.
Is there any risk, though, that this approach could stifle innovation? I mean, this has been such a growth area, particularly for the Bay Area economy.
I don't think this will stifle innovation in any way. First of all, we have a piece of the bill that will actually expand innovation by creating a public cloud to provide compute access for less well-resourced individuals and companies, because compute has gotten so expensive that we're at risk of the large companies pricing out the small companies. In addition, having smart, transparent safety practices is good for innovation. It increases public confidence in the technology. and it levels the playing field. So I think this only promotes and improves the atmosphere for innovation in California. And it, again, keeps California in the lead when it comes to AI.
And what do you see as kind of next steps on AI regulation? Are you going to wait and see how this plays out, or do you have plans for further legislative efforts to regulate AI?
I don't have specific plans. I mean, there are other areas that are important that other legislators have been working on, for example, around deepfakes, around the future of work, which is a really hard issue because technology has always, going back millennia, created change in how people work and what kinds of jobs exist or don't exist, whether it's the printing press or the personal computer or the loom to weave clothing. There's always been new technology that creates change in work. But historically, these changes in technology would take decades, even centuries, to truly have big impacts. Even the personal computer was very gradual and took years and years to have the kinds of impacts that we've seen. AI, the innovation and the changes happening around AI are happening so quickly that we're going to see very, very quick change in terms of work and what jobs exist and no longer exist. Yeah. And it is unclear to me that society can absorb that change as quickly as it's coming. And that is concerning to many of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, before we wrap up and I let you go, I have to ask you about another major piece of legislation you authored, SB 79, which would allow taller residential buildings near major transit stops to boost housing production. It's been on the governor's desk since September 12th. I know this was your third bite at the apple and finally got it over the legislative finish line. Some chatter about the governor maybe wavering on this due to some homeowner resistance in places like LA. Any updates from you on whether he'll sign it or when that might happen?
So I don't read anything into the timing. The governor has many, many, many bills left on his desk. I sent him 12 bills. He's only acted on two of them. I think he's going to act on a few more today. So it's been a little bit slow going. So I don't read anything into the timing. Governor Newsom has been a strong advocate for housing, and I know he's giving it a very open-minded review. It's unfortunate that some folks in Los Angeles, including the mayor, have been working so hard against the bill. It's really unnecessary, but that's their right. And I'm hopeful the governor will really see what's going on here, that we need more housing and it should be near our highest quality public transportation.
Well, we'll have to see what happens with that and have you back on if and when the governor signs it into law. But thank you so much for joining us again, Senator Wiener. Always a pleasure to have you on State of the Bay.
Thank you.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we're talking about the future of autonomous vehicles and how they may redefine the ways that we move, work, and live. So stay with us.
KALW is launching a new monthly series to meet the moment in these contentious times. It's called Difficult Conversations, bringing together top thinkers who see the world in different ways for a thoughtful and provocative discussion of today's biggest issues. The first one is about AI in the workplace. It's happening live at Manny's in San Francisco's Mission District this Wednesday evening at 7:30. Join KALW for the first of many Difficult Conversations. You can find more info at kalw.org/events.
Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. In their first season, the Golden State Valkyries created a movement bigger than themselves.
The atmosphere in here is so electric, and we're all just having a great time. And it's an escape from everything else that's going on in the world.
The finale of Bounce, the Valkyries' first season in the Bay. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Autonomous vehicles are no longer a novel sight on Bay Area streets. They're driving passengers to work, to school, to nights on the town, and pretty soon they're going to be taking travelers to and from airports in the region here. They've also made some negative headlines after a San Bruno Waymo was caught making an illegal U-turn, and a Waymo in Atlanta illegally passed a stopped school bus. But as their presence multiplies, what environmental, safety, and logistical concerns do they raise or potentially alleviate? And how will they change the way that we move, work, and live? Here to discuss these questions and more, we're very pleased to welcome Dr. William Riggs, professor at the University of San Francisco School of Management and the director of the Autonomous Vehicles and the City Initiative. Welcome to State of the Bay, Billy.
Hey, good morning. Or wow, it's not the morning anymore. Sorry. Good evening.
Well, we'd like to think we have international listeners, so it's probably a morning somewhere where somebody's listening, but good
oh
to have you join us. And we're also pleased to be joined by Dr. Susan Shaheen, professor in residence of civil and environmental engineering at UC Berkeley and co-director of the Transportation Sustainability Research Center. Thanks for joining us again, Susan.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
And we're also happy to have Jeff Tumlin join the conversation. He's the former executive director of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Jeff.
Hi, Ethan. Always happy to be on public radio.
Absolutely. Always appreciate the support for public radio. And before we begin this segment, we want to hear from you as well, our listeners. Do you have stories to share about your experience riding in an autonomous vehicle? Would you give up owning a car if you could summon a driverless one on demand? You can call us now. The phone lines are open. That number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. You can also leave comments for us on social media as well. So, Susan, let me start with you. Can you give us an overview of where autonomous vehicle technology stands right now? Is this current technology here to stay, or can we expect any major new advancements?
Yeah, great question. So automated vehicles and driverless vehicles, I would predict, are here to stay. Some fun facts to share with you. In 2024, we had about 60 million miles of operations between just China and US in terms of robotaxis. And Waymo has been leading the way with what we call an S-curve in terms of driverless miles. So in August of 2023, Waymo provided 12,000 autonomous rides in the state of California. And in August of 2024, just 12 months later, 312,000. So people are using these vehicles and there's a lot of competition. We've got big players out there, including Waymo and Zoox, that's owned by Amazon. Everybody must have heard about Tesla with their Cybercab and RoboVan. They were actually unveiled in October of 2024. And my last round of research on this indicated 47 automated driving players were functioning across the globe, and 17 were operating on the ground, on the roads.
So there's a lot of proliferation here of this technology. And as I said in the intro, people see it happening all around us already on the streets. Now, Billy, your lab works with a number of companies producing driverless cars. What do you see on the horizon when it comes to how autonomous vehicle AV fleets are designed and deployed?
Yeah, well, I was going to piggyback on Susan, and I see a lot of global competition in this market. And I was going to say, I see a lot of Chinese competition on the forefront. And a couple of the companies that she didn't mention are some ones, Pony and WeRide and BYD, which is actually a Tesla competitor. But there's some, you know, there's some Chinese companies that have some really sophisticated software that are really hot on the heels of you know, our homegrown talent here in the Bay Area. So we really have an acceleration in software that's coupled with this. So this brain in the car. This coupled with hardware advances, and that's really just creating this acceleration in driving safety. And I think anybody that's experienced some of these vehicles knows that it's a pretty fantastic and elegant ride. And we've been researching this since, you know, the behavioral experience and now the kind of the business model, both in the US and in Europe and in Asia, now for since 2020, when we start to see real world deployments and kind of researching how people are behaving. And what we're really seeing is kind of the first part of what we're seeing is people kind of using it as a replacement for rideshare. And that's mm-hmm. really the initial trend of what we're seeing. And yes. Maybe I'll just drop the mic right there and defer to my other guests.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And perhaps pivoting off of that point, Jeff Tumlin, I want to bring you into this conversation as a transportation expert and also as someone who ran an agency, being the former executive director of Muni here in San Francisco. What do you think should be the top priority for cities as they think about how to manage and regulate AVs on their streets?
Well, there's a lot of potential upside. I'm a regular Waymo user, and I'm utterly fascinated just watching its development. Waymos follow the speed limit. They're amazing at predicting cyclist and pedestrian behavior, and they're good for many types of individuals, people who are visually impaired or neurodivergent or vulnerable, like trans folks who don't want to be with a human driver. But they also have some unintended downsides. They do much of their pickup and drop off in the traffic lane or in the bike lane. They have a hard time understanding human traffic control officers or first responders or construction sites. And while they're very good at avoiding collisions, one of the consequences of that is that when AVs get confused, they tend to come to a complete stop wherever they happen to be, therefore creating unintended safety and traffic consequences for the rest of the mobility network. So for cities, we're really eager to find ways for cities to successfully partner with AV companies in order to help them accelerate, to capture their upside, and to minimize the downsides for the overall transportation system. Mm-hmm.
Well, that really does seem like the crux of the question. How do we harness the positives of this technology without getting damaged by the negatives, foreseeable or unforeseeable? And on that topic, I want to ask you, Susan Shaheen at UC Berkeley, what are researchers projecting about the environmental trade-offs of autonomous vehicles? I know in California, AVs are required to be electric or zero emission, which might indicate that they'd be climate friendly. But an MIT study from 2023 found that AV computers and sensors, and I would think overall driving miles, will massively increase total energy demand compared to EVs just with regular drivers. So where does that leave us when we're thinking about the climate impact of AVs in terms of energy demand and just in terms of overall driving miles and the impact on our traffic?
Yeah, great question. So our research at Berkeley is really focused a lot on the sharing of vehicles because that's going to have a better chance of reducing vehicle miles traveled and greenhouse gas emissions. We spent a long time working with both Uber and Lyft and the Natural Resources Defense Council on a study that included San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. And what I can tell you is on net, you know, we have found increases in what we call vehicle miles traveled. That's a term or a metric we use a lot in transportation, VMT, and greenhouse gas emissions. We saw this in both San Francisco and Los Angeles, but we did see a slight decrease in VMT and GHG in Washington, D.C. comparatively. We think this might be due to the land use and built environment effects and factors in Washington, D.C. that led to that, in contrast to the California market. The other thing that we can look at as a proxy would be how have people responded to auto ownership in light of having access to services that are really similar to a shared automated vehicle like a Waymo or a Zoox. And what we found with ride-hailing companies, that we do see a reduction in TNC or transportation network company passengers. And in that ownership, is about 10.5% reduction in San Francisco. We found about 10.9% reduction in LA and 7.4% in Washington, D.C. So with an average overall of about 9.6. So what does this mean? It means that people could either give up a car or remain carless. And so there's the effects of that, which we need to take into consideration overall. But when you describe automated vehicles that could be privately owned, these cars could be taking people to work, drop them off, drive home. So we've got to really have a keen eye on what the total effects are if they're shared or privately owned automated vehicles.
And Billy, I wanted to ask you the same question, basically, about how do we address what the traffic impact might be of all of these vehicles. What does your research tell you about just the total driving miles that might happen here?
Yeah, well, I agree a lot with Susan on the, I think there's a big opportunity to reduce car ownership. I mean, I think we've done some research with, actually not with Waymo, but looking some, you know, Waymo did a really interesting experiment last year, and we kind of hacked some of their data. They did an experiment where they gave people a transit incentive to get dropped off near regional BART stations. And we went out and we threw students at people getting out of Waymos, getting on these BART stations with a Waymo incentive. And if you want, I can give you some of our data. But long story short is a lot of these people were transit dependent and they didn't own vehicles. And so it's really interesting, but they were more or less captive to low capacity transit. They were lines that were running hour long headways that didn't always work for them. And in Jeff's defense, you know, Jeff and I live in the same neighborhood and occasionally hang out. And I would say he had an impossible job when he ran the MTA. It's how on a Spartan budget do you have, you know, 10 minute, 15 minute, 20 minute headways for your buses that really work for people who demand reliable and convenient transit. And to be honest, the real opportunity, I think, for some of these on demand services is really to fill in the gaps. And I think that is a real opportunity for people that are captive. And sometimes I think we use the term captive to transit, that they don't own a vehicle. They are, my old dissertation chair, Bob Cervero, he works at Berkeley, used to be colleague of Susan, used to say, these are choice transit riders. And we want to keep choice transit riders in transit. We don't want them buying cars. And that is part of our good environmental narrative. And by keeping them choice transit riders, this, you know, I think AVs are part of that future story. So yes. Jeff and I, we debate this a lot. Yeah. So we can probably turn it to Jeff now, Ethan.
No, I do want to hear from Jeff, but if you're just joining us, I want to let listeners know this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind, and tonight we're discussing what a future with autonomous vehicles might look like, and we're joined by Dr. William Riggs, professor at the University of San Francisco School of Management and the director of the Autonomous Vehicles and the City Initiative. Also joined by Dr. Susan Shaheen, professor in residence of civil and environmental engineering at UC Berkeley and co-director of the Transportation Sustainability Research Center. And also joined by Jeff Tumlin, former executive director of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, SF Muni. And we'd love to hear from you. Are you excited about a future with more autonomous vehicles on the street, or does it make you nervous? Do you feel safe riding next to, or inside of, for that matter, a driverless car? You can call us now. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we have a caller from Alameda, Heather, joining us on State of the Bay. Heather, welcome to the program.
Hi. My question is, who do we call if we almost get hit by one of these things? I was returning from a performance at the Atrium and Civic Center, and I was about almost halfway across a large intersection when this vehicle entered, you know, it ignored the red light, and the fact that there was a pedestrian in the crosswalk, it almost hit me. And if there had even been an inattentive human in the vehicle, it would have heard me screaming and swearing at it. Mm-hmm. So these things should be made so that they can react to outside sounds that might slow traffic down. But if you're endangering the public, you know, we should have a chance at surviving, you know, crossing, you know, walking in the city without being, you know, mowed down by one of these stupid things.
Yes.
You know,
well, Heather, first of all, I'm sorry you had that.
A taxi driver, you know, to save a couple of human lives. Now, I have some friends who think, well, people get killed by cars all the time. Why add extra danger to the city surface?
No, thank you, Heather, for sharing that story. I'm sorry that happened to you. I'm just curious, Billy, can you answer that question? Who does someone like Heather call when these kinds of incidents, we hope they don't happen, but when they do happen, who should she get in touch with?
Well, I Jeff will probably have the same. You can dial, you can call SFPD if you live in San Francisco. That is also, but also Waymo, I've worked with as a researcher with Waymo enough that I do know that Waymo does invite you to report near collisions and near incidences. So you can go to their website, and it's actually waymo.com/notify.
Okay.
I actually knew that because we've actually worked with their emergency management team before. They've done a really, we've done a couple panels with their law enforcement and first responder team. In 2022, 2023, I think Jeff can tell you it was a tough summer of working through all the works of working through some stuff with first responders. There was a lot of influx of AV rides on our streets, and we had some challenges that summer. And I think there was a lot of work we did in intercept in kind of working through some early challenges. I don't know, Jeff, if you want to.
Yeah, this is a significant issue for autonomous vehicles in California. Please don't call your local police department, because in California, local police cannot issue a moving violation on AVs. Moving violations go to the driver, not to the vehicle. So this creates a real problem when autonomous vehicles break the law or violate pedestrian right-of-way. This is something that we hope to address in the state legislature, but currently remains a major challenge.
Yes, thank you, Jeff.
But the cities want to log it, right, Jeff? Jeff, you want to log it, right?
Right, but you can call in San Francisco, you can call 311 to log it. That does very little, though, to prevent incidents like that from happening again.
Yeah.
So I want to read an email from Rick in Citrus Heights, who wrote in, "While I like the fact that the city of San Francisco has Waymo, because public transportation is being not just cut, but chopped, what about us up here in Sacramento, Placer, and El Dorado counties? Why should I, as a blind person, be at the mercy of another human being?" Jeff, I'm curious if you have thoughts in response. I'm sure you heard some similar types of comments when you were in charge of Muni.
That's right. So one of the things that we are really intrigued by with regard to AVs is how well they serve people who are visually impaired, trans folks, women, people who are neurodivergent and have a hard time interacting with other humans. AVs create really significant benefits for those populations. But at the same time, AVs currently have no viable strategy for handling passengers who use wheelchairs, or people who are vulnerable coming home from a dialysis appointment. So there are still many kinds of trips that really need a human operator in order to facilitate vulnerable users or to make shared rides safe for everyone.
Mm-hmm. All right, we have another caller, Julie in San Francisco, dialing in. Julie, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you. I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes, please continue.
Okay, good, sorry. It was a little quiet there.
We were listening for you, so let's go ahead.
In the process of these vehicles being tried out here and expanded, has there been any effort to require the companies that provide the vehicles to make the vehicles cradle to cradle so they don't become an abandoned car down the line? and wind up in the dump.
Yeah, that's a good question about what happens to them. Susan Shaheen, I'm curious if this is something you've looked at, or has this been on the radar at all of folks working on autonomous vehicle issues?
Yeah, great question, Ethan, and the caller. In terms of life cycle analysis, which is basically what we apply to, you know, the cradle to grave, if you will, I have not seen anything on AVs, nor have I seen any legislation to this effect. But we are seeing more and more analysis about the full life cycle of a transportation mode in the literature. So we're starting to document that, which I think is a really good step in the right direction in order to develop evidence-based policy for ensuring that we don't end up with a lot of AVs in a dumpster situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Ethan, I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding on behalf of the caller, because you know, Waymo is not a vehicle manufacturer. I think that's Waymo is a software company. Mm-hmm. The vehicle manufacturer happens to be Jaguar. But the vehicle manufacturer in the next generation will be a company called Zeekr, which is actually owned by Geely Automotive. And the next generation will be Hyundai. And each of these companies, may have a different strategy for vehicle lifecycle. For example, I know that BMW has a very stringent lifecycle vehicle policy, as does Audi. But I can't speak for, you know, and I know that Geely Automotive, being owned by Volvo, or being part of Volvo Automotive, has a very stringent, life cycle strategy. Mm-hmm. But I can't speak for this I-PACE you see on the road. I don't know what their total kind of life cycle strategy is, but I think it's a little bit much to put on Waymo as a software company the burden of the hardware.
Yes, I think it's a good point, and a lot of interest in reusing batteries from electric vehicles in general, and of course recycling them. Now, if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay, local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the future of autonomous vehicles, joined by Dr. William Riggs from the University of San Francisco, also Susan Shaheen from UC Berkeley, and Jeff Tumlin, former executive director of SF Muni. Phone lines are open. We only have a few minutes left. If you have a question for us, want to dial in, the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or go ahead and email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We have an email question from Lisa in El Cerrito, who writes, "I'm most concerned that the widespread use of autonomous vehicles will undo years of land use policy for denser pedestrian and bicycle-oriented urban centers. To make autonomous cars more efficient, we will go back to car-centric planning. I wish we had higher corporate taxes so that the investment in self-driving vehicles could be invested by the public into public transit with more lines and shorter headways." Jeff Tumlin, as someone who ran a transit agency, what are your thoughts about the concern Lisa's raising, that this is going to bring us back to that sort of 1950s automobile-dependent type of community as opposed to a more walkable, vibrant, convenient one?
That is exactly the concern that we have. We feel in many ways like we're repeating 2015 all over again, when Uber and Lyft were both promising that their services would reduce congestion, would connect people to transit, facilitate car-free lifestyles. And John Zimmer at Lyft made a real good faith effort to achieve those goals and failed. Not only did Uber and Lyft fail to achieve those goals, they worsened every single outcome. And that's detailed in the SFCTA's 2018 study on ride-hail impacts. We're seeing the exact same thing repeat itself all over again. Indeed, for Waymo and Zoox to be able to compete against Uber, they need to offer a lower price point, which will simply increase vehicle miles traveled in San Francisco, which is maybe good for a user convenience standpoint, but it's bad for the city. Because when I drive or take Uber or take a Waymo, I take up 10 times as much roadway space as I do walking or biking or taking transit. There's a fundamental urban geometry problem that means that while Waymos may be convenient from a user perspective, they're incredibly inefficient from a transportation system perspective, which will simply increase the pressure to carve out more space for cars. That's our worry, and one of the downsides that we need to manage through congestion pricing, through transit-only lanes, through protected bike lanes, and other infrastructure that prioritizes the most space-efficient and economically efficient modes of transportation.
Yes. So, Susan, I'm going to give you the last word here. We're just about out of time, but looking ahead 10, 20 years, what is your prediction for how autonomous vehicles might shape what life is like here in the Bay Area?
Well, wow, that's a really great question, Ethan. And I think a lot of it lies in the hands of our communities and cities, right? To say, what kind of world do we want to live in? And Jeffrey's raised some great points, right? About, do we want to go back in time and relive similar lessons, or do we want to move forward based on what we know from ride hailing and try to manage it better? There's clearly significant benefits with automation, but there's also going to be negative consequences if we don't manage them properly and balance out the objectives of our cities so that cities are for people.
Yes, and not necessarily for computerized cars. There's obviously a lot more we can discuss here. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for tonight. I just want to thank each of you for joining us. Dr. William Riggs from University of San Francisco School of Management, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Dr. Susan Shaheen, Professor in Residence of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UC Berkeley, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And last but not least, thank you to Jeff Tumlin, former Executive Director of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. Thank you, Jeff.
Public radio for the win.
There you go. I love it. So coming up after the break, we're going to hear from my co-host Grace Wan and her interview with the director of Fairyland, a coming-of-age film set in San Francisco. So stay with us.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6 here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area and online at kalw.org.
KALW is launching a new monthly series to meet the moment in these contentious times. It's called Difficult Conversations, bringing together top thinkers who see the world in different ways for a thoughtful and provocative discussion of today's biggest issues. The first one is about AI in the workplace. It's happening live at Manny's in San Francisco's Mission District this Wednesday evening at 7:30. Join KALW for the first of many Difficult Conversations. You can find more info at kalw.org/events.
Welcome back. I'm Grace Wan. San Francisco is at the heart of Fairyland, a new film produced by Sofia Coppola and adapted from Alicia Abbott's acclaimed 2013 memoir. It's a story of a young girl and her single gay father trying to make a life together, first in the city's colorful bohemian 1970s, and then through the devastating years of the AIDS crisis. The film is written and directed by Andrew Durham. It's his first feature, but Andrew is no stranger to storytelling. He studied film at USC, worked with directors like David Lynch and Oliver Stone, and spent years as a photographer shooting for Vanity Fair, The New York Times, and Dior. He also has a long creative partnership with Sofia Coppola, photographing behind the scenes on her sets. And Fairyland is deeply personal for him. Like Alicia Abbott, Andrew also grew up with a gay father in the Bay Area and cared for him during the AIDS epidemic. That personal history makes this film not just an adaptation, but a story Andrew has lived in his own way. Welcome to State of the Bay, Andrew.
Thank you very much for having me, Grace.
Well, as we were saying, your own story overlaps with Alicia Abbott in powerful ways. How did that overlap shape how you approached adapting the book?
there were so many similarities in my own experience that I recognized in Alicia's memoir that were surprising initially, because when you experience something like this when you're a kid, my brother and I probably thought we were the only people in the world with a gay father, and then the only people in the world with a father who had AIDS. As much as I grew up in the Bay Area and this epidemic seemed to be everywhere at the time, it still hadn't really affected our day-to-day lives. But when my parents got divorced, my dad moved up to San Francisco, and my brother and I stayed down in the suburbs. So there was a kind of two separate worlds that we lived. I recognized that in Alicia Abbott's memoir, which was so, and this is, mind you, 30-something years later, it was such kind of a relief to me, and it was so exciting to me that, wow, someone else had lived such a similar life at the exact same time.
Mm. Well, you know, coming of age is at the heart of this movie, but it's not just Alicia who's growing up. Her father, Steve, is also going through his own kind of second adolescence as he starts to live this openly out life. What drew you to that dual coming of age theme? I mean, is that something that you know that your father experienced while you were experiencing it as well?
Yeah, that was something that I thought was so interesting in Alicia's memoir, because it's a unique way to tell a coming of age story. We don't see a lot of the parallel coming of age story. And she really focuses on that in the memoir. And I noticed that it took me a while as I sort of got older and looking back at my dad and his life and realizing that so many of these men of this, specifically of this generation that probably grew up in the 50s, led very sort of suppressed, you know, they called it closeted lifestyles, and didn't really get to go through what would be a traditional adolescence and sort of coming of age openly. So a lot of these guys kind of came out and almost were like teenagers because they were getting to do all those things, honestly, that they didn't get to do when they were younger. And that sort of dating and, you know, messing around and one night stands and all that kind of stuff that a lot of like straight kids go through in high school that they probably take for granted. But imagine not feeling comfortable or not being allowed to do that until you're an adult. And so I just thought that was such a unique part of Alicia's story, that as she's becoming a teenager, he's really coming into himself. And you sort of see how those two have a lot in common. But I saw that with my dad and his friends too, and the freedom. And I think that there was some scrutiny on the gay community back then about it's promiscuous. But if you put it into the context of these guys didn't really go through an adolescence when most of their peers were, I think they're allowed to do it later in life. Mm. As long as you do it, you know?
Right, exactly. Exactly. Well, I know you've said in previous interviews that one hope you had for this film is that it shows you more than one way to be a good parent, particularly a single father, because in Alicia's case, her mother had passed away. She was killed in a car accident. So really, it was just her dad. And I wonder if you could share more about that, because I think as particularly of the representation of single fathers at that moment, the only movie that really comes to mind is Kramer versus Kramer, you know, which was a very different kind of film.
It's a different movie, Grace, but it was a bit of an inspiration for me.
Mm.
So it's interesting when that movie Kramer versus Kramer came out when I was a kid, it was probably around the time my parents were just getting divorced too. And I often thought about, wow, what would it be like if my brother and I lived with our dad? And there's this idea that, well, men don't really know how to raise a kid. They don't understand housework and taking the kids back to school, shopping or cooking. Mm-hmm. Or anything. So there's some of those stereotypes, which might be a little accurate, but that's just where society has put emphasis on what people's roles are. But I learned a lot from Alicia's book, reading that and how different it was. I mean, it was also the era where a lot of kids were pretty feral. We didn't.
Exactly. Exactly.
We're helicopter parents back then. Exactly. We were running around pretty wild. But I saw it from a different perspective when I read Alicia's book. And I really tried to take a lot of what she said and the struggles of a single man trying to raise a kid when there wasn't a lot of support, probably, I imagine. Mm-hmm. So, you know, thank you
for the pill. Yeah. Kramer, it actually helped.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I think one of the more poignant, I mean, it's all very poignant, actually. It's a really lovely film. But there's a moment when Alicia says to her father, she's older, she's like, you really abandoned me. You ignored me. You left me alone a lot. And he says, I was trying to teach you to be independent. And it's this moment when each of them is looking at their family life from such different perspectives. But you can feel like the love that they have for each other, even through that disappointment and anger. How did that feel as a filmmaker to be able to capture that?
This was my first feature that I have directed. And I didn't really grasp how much I had to rely on actors to bring a whole next level. I thought, oh, I'm going to write this. It's going to be exactly the way I wrote it. And it's my vision. And then when you are lucky enough to have such talented, talented people kind of come on board and they bring their interpretations of this, and they were so good at interpreting things. It's such a unique experience to see your script come alive in front of the camera. And they bring those complicated nuances and performances to the scenes that they really, I have to owe a lot of that to answer your question, where like, how were you able to manage? And like, that's a lot of Scoot and Amelia. Like they really knew how to do it with just their looks and their eyes and their, and just like the look of disappointment in their face or their look of happiness in their face or their look of anger in their face. I just let them read the words and interpret it. And I was so lucky that they did that. So I learned a big lesson. And I know now moving forward, it's like, I've got to really find really talented actors because I know they're just going to elevate everything that I write so much more, that make it so much more relatable to the audience.
Well, your casting agent did a fantastic job with Amelia Jones, who plays the older Alicia, and Scoot McNairy, who's Steve, the father. But another character in this movie is definitely San Francisco. And Alicia has written that after she sold the rights to her book, she had a chance to share her version of what San Francisco was with you all. And tell me a little bit about the set design, because we're talking about San Francisco in the 70s and 80s. And honestly, when that old-timey Muni bus rolled up, I was like, nailed it.
I'm so glad that you noticed the bus. That I'm a little bit of a stickler for stuff like that. And I was so happy to hear that. And San Francisco is one great thing about the city is on the surface, it hasn't changed that much when you're looking at the architecture. It's a beautiful city, and I think there's been a lot of effort to preserve that. So all those row houses and that Victorian arch, I mean, it's all there. It hasn't changed so much from when I was a kid. Yes, you have to avoid those bike paths that are painted bright green. Mm. Or there's certain things like satellite dishes, but the actual, you know, architecture of the city looks so similar. But we had such a wonderful art department. They were just incredible, and they were able to take, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Mare Island, which is over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Just, I mean, this isn't really a spoiler, and I hope I'm not ruining the movie for anyone, but we would shoot our exteriors in San Francisco proper. So every time we're out there, apartment, and they're running in and outside an apartment, or they're in Golden Gate Park, we're in the city. But we actually shot our interiors of all those apartments in these old captain mansions, Navy captain mansions that are over on Mare Island.
You know, the period where the era in which this movie ends is the era in which so many young men died of AIDS. And I wonder, you know, as you were putting that together, that piece together, and having nursed your own father through this, what do you want people to remember from that time? And what's the imprint you want this film to have in its record of that moment?
Well, I think it's important that we never, ever forget these chapters in our history. I worry sometimes that the younger gay community and all the young queer kids now, I'm surprised how little they know about that time. And I think that's just up to all of us that live through that to keep reminding them. I think they need to be constantly reminded of it. It's history. It's American history. It's queer history. It's just something that we need to keep reminding people of.
We've been talking to Andrew Durham, the producer, writer, and director of the new film Fairyland. It's going to be coming out on October 10th, and it's something you should definitely try to see. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Oh, thank you, Grace. It was a pleasure.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We're off next week, but be sure to join us again on October 20th. If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. You can find out more information on our State of the Bay page at kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Katie Colley. It was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. Stay tuned to hear an episode of Your Call series, The Authoritarian Playbook. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.